Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky.
Adam.
And hey. As always, I don't know if you guys know this, but the NIDS View is a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, which
it's
really kind of a great organization that talks about, you know, the podcast is great, but the organization's great too. It's got great folks.
Yeah.
It has an admirable mission.
Great leaders. I'll tell you, great leadership too, by
the way. Yeah. Fantastic podcast engineer.
And by the way, it's part of the NIDS podcasting network. We're a whole network of podcasts.
That's right.
Yeah. So here we are. And for today's topic, you know, we talk about sort of current events, but one of the things that we've talked about so many different things over the last, 2 years now that we've been doing this, that one thing that we have never really sat down and talked about is if you could really choose what you would do to make things better. Like if you had 3 wishes, for example, what would you do? You know, what would be those top 3 things that you would want done for, you know, the nuclear enterprise, national security writ large? And so we thought, well, let's each take our top 3 most important things and, you know, offer them up to the, you know, to the group and you know, maybe explain why you think they're so important. And then, you know, the slings and arrows may come or somebody else may say, well, you know, those are pretty good. They're not as good as mine, but they're still pretty good. So that's what we thought we'd do today. And, you know, maybe the listeners will have their own, you know, things that they think are the most important things that if they could do whatever they wanted, they'd do them. And so feel free to send us what you think is most important and needs to be done. And we may respond back to you or throw you a shout or whatever. So why don't we start with you? I usually start with Curtis, but I'm going to start with you today, Jim. And why don't you kick us off? So Jim Petrosky, our technical guy, you've got 3 things or 3 choices that you could, you know, do whatever you want with. What do you think are those 3 things that need to be done or that are like the most important?
Well, thanks, Adam. And yeah, thanks for passing it to me first. This is a really good exercise, I think, for all of our listeners to sit down and think, maybe not of the 3, but maybe think of the things that they really put on their wish list in the direction we're going with our nuclear enterprise. But I was thinking about how to do this. And when you first talked about this, Adam, and Adam usually comes up with our show material. So if you don't like it, write to Adam. But anyway, and if you do like it, write to me because I'm in charge. But anyway, so I thought about, you know, my 3 favorite things, and it made me think of a song that came out, you know, in a movie just before World War II that was sung to a series of children to comfort them. And I think of nuclear weapons, you know, comforting me. So I thought I'd start out with my little limerick first, or a little bit of a song. And it goes like this: submarine launchers and bombers on bases, satellites in space that can guide them to places, B-83 attached to the wings. These are a few of my favorite things. And the reason I do that, and I know it's a little silly, but, you know, the idea is that these things comfort me. And so those things are there. And I believe you two will talk more about those items. But I'm going to take a completely different, hopefully different view than you're going to take. And I think of when I was a kid at Christmas, I thought of all the things. But as I get older, I have not things, but sort of time spent, et cetera, on things. And so let me hit the things that I have to answer your question and hopefully get our listeners to follow up on. My first is a revitalization of the national knowledge and understanding of the nuclear enterprise. I think we as a nation have lost that direction. And so I'm not asking for universal agreement or even support. In fact, I don't think universal agreement in the country, although some might think that's nice, I don't think that's valuable. But instead, I just want us as a nation to get to some level of understanding so that we can engage in meaningful debates and productive discussions rather than just disregarding each other's differing viewpoints and throwing around, you know, slogans, et cetera, which is where I think the nuclear enterprise has gone for a majority of the United States. That's my, you know, my opinion. And so I want to see this real revitalization. Now, many people, excluding our listeners, of course, because you're all, you know, into this, but most people are unaware of the surety investment that ensures our weapons are safe and secure, as well as the strategies that are designed to maintain the availability as a deterrent. And regardless of your stance on current policies, weapons, or methods, I think it's essential to build knowledge that citizens can evaluate our nation's actions effectively. Perhaps we need something akin to Top Gun movie that it did for Navy recruiting, if you ever knew that. Navy recruiting went through the roof right after Top Gun.
It did.
And I thought that would happen with Oppenheimer, but it's sort of fizzled out already. So maybe we need another, you know, cool movie to, you know, bring this about so people understand that. So I think that's one. Now I'm going to go on to number two. Wait, before I do that, I do have another thing. I do think that we need to, you know, look at all the pieces of the nuclear deterrence as well, whether it's diplomacy and agreements. All of those pieces also fit into citizenry understanding what's going on. And I think that even practicing maybe some of those survival skills like we did in the 60s, you know, I did duck and cover. I'm telling you, it led to no long-term psychological issues. For those of you that have never met me, at least that's what I'm going to claim. But we'd also probably save lives because a lot of that concept of survivability applies to natural disasters, whether they be earthquakes or you know, large asteroids hitting the Earth. There's all kinds of things that can happen that you'd be prepared for. So we'd be a better prepared nation. So I like saving lives because we're a peace organization and peace saves lives. All right. So my second one. Okay. Educational and skill development to support our nuclear enterprise, I think, is number two on my list. And it's one of my biggest concerns for the nuclear enterprise is that of the workforce. And people that know me know I say, you know, always tongue in cheek, how long does it take to build a 15-year expert? And I say that to highlight the importance of the time lag. If we start today building our expert, we got 15 years till we have a 15-year expert. And we don't have time to wait 15 years right now. And it takes a long time to understand the, you know, get the knowledge of concepts of nuclear reactions and biological hazards, nuclear chemistry, mathematics, computation. You fill in all of those things. It takes a long time to learn that. But we also need people to learn those valuable technical discipline, or valuable technical disciplines, but also those valuable and vital trade skills. You know, we need to build electricians, pipe fitters, heavy equipment operators, supply specialists, concrete masons. And these are all, by the way, for our listeners and anyone that you can pass this on to, these are great jobs and great careers in the nuclear enterprise. But you don't just take your average equipment operator and throw them out in the nuclear enterprise. There's all kinds of other things they have to meet. So it takes a long time. Okay. So I would ask for a national effort to build the right skills and build the careers that have a long-term commitment. That's the key, because our nuclear enterprise and the modernization effort is a long-term effort. It's not going to be done next year. When we're looking at what 2065, we need careers that are developed now that are going to last through then. So that's my second wish. And lastly, and I think the thing that frustrates me the most is we need a streamlined, sort of flexible, modern logistics management and personnel management system that can react to the needs of the enterprise. I think the enterprise has like specialized equipment, exceedingly stringent tolerances for equipment, and necessary safety and security oversight. And, you know, I'm almost always asked by Adam, you know, can a scientist make this work? And my answer is always what, gentlemen?
Yes.
Yes.
It always works. Yeah.
You guys sound enthusiastic. Yes, they always make it work. The problem is all that other stuff they have to get through. Okay. The problem with getting much of our capability out there, it's stifled by the oversight and you know, that basically reduces what I've always referred to as the three I's: ingenuity, innovation, and intellectual pursuit. They all get lost when you start to get in the way with all these other pieces. Now, I'm not saying we need to stop having safety and security oversight, because how many of our nuclear weapons have been stolen, gentlemen?
Zero.
None.
Zero. How many nuclear weapons have accidentally gone off when they weren't supposed to, gentlemen?
Zero.
None.
Zero. We have a great, great track record. So I don't want to get rid of that, but we need to find a way to make the process of safety and security oversight and logistics management all work together in a special way for the special thing called the nuclear enterprise. So I'll go back to my other comment. How long does it take to build a 15-year expert? Well, it takes 15 years, or you can't find a new method. We need a new method. The tools and equipment, the intellect is there. We need to get out of the way and let things happen. And so these are my sincere wishes, my three favorite things that I am offering for the nuclear enterprise. Gentlemen, take a shot at me. Throw your spears at them. Go ahead.
Well, I honestly can't say. The only thing I would say is I kind of you stepped on one of my wishes. So that's I guess it's good that
I like we're, that.
Well, you know, we're you know, in G there. So that's good. But
you aren't going to sing, though, are you?
No. You will never get me to sing. I'm far worse than a screeching cat. So so good choices. Can't complain about what you said. How about you, Curtis? Let's turn it to you.
I can't complain. Those are awesome. Well, thanks. I gave some thought to this, and I think mine dovetail nicely with Jim's wishes. And although mine may be, I don't know, maybe a little bit, I just a little more grandiose in the thinking, in the sense of where it's playing out. I'm not trying to say that Jim didn't have grandiose thinking.
Weapons on Mars thing again?
No, I'm not that far out. So my first wish is to change the cultural and political commitment to deterrence versus defense in this country. Now, I have been accused of being what I refer to as a deterrence maximalist. And it is an accusation that I wear proudly. And so I'm a firm believer that deterrence is, it should always be our first goal, right? And we see it play out in a lot of our doctrine. We sort of mouth the words, but we don't really, I think, are as committed as a nation as maybe we once were when we were ducking and covering in elementary school in the 1950s. Let me remind our audience that deterrence is an effort that seeks to prevent, right, an attack or a hostile action by threatening serious consequences through the fear of intolerable response. And it relies on the potential aggressor believing that maintaining the status quo or addressing grievances through diplomatically is better than attempting to change that status quo through armed conflict. Now, a defense, on the other hand, it really is about responding to the attack or the act of armed aggression. Combat is what happens when deterrence fails. And so what concerns me the most is that when we look at how we arm, how we procure weapons, how we do defense budgets, and what we prioritize, we seem to prioritize war fighting equipment, generally non-nuclear, over the things we need to avert the war. And I think it's because we don't place a priority in the theory and concept of deterrence. We have to get out of that mindset. Let's stop buying the things that prosecute war, or in a sense, or I say buying as much, of the things that actually prosecute war when deterrence fails. And let's buy the things and do the things we need to do to avert the war in the first place. As Adam likes to remind me that I remind everyone else, in war, you pay for everything twice, right? When the tank blows up, that's the first purchase, and then you got to pay to replace it. But in deterrence, you only pay once, because the goal is to have the weapon system postured, ready. It's the scarecrow, so to speak. So I think we just really need to have this this cultural commitment to place deterrence and nuclear weapons acquisition and deployment, if you will, at a higher priority than conventional or non-nuclear weapons. And thus we place our focus on averting war more than prosecuting it. So that's my first wish. My second is improving our commitment to projecting deterrence. Again, I'm a deterrence maximalist. I'm one who does not believe that we do this very well. Allies are unassured. They're actively discussing nuclear proliferation and other nuclear defensive arrangements, while adversaries are undaunted and act with impunity, specifically around Taiwan, for example. And the U.S. and allies reward them with trade dollars and euros. We fund proxy wars, and we send harshly worded demarches. And if we don't project deterrence, nuclear or otherwise, the opportunity to avert a Taiwan invasion will be as evident as Ukraine was. And so I really think that we can no longer afford to be everywhere all the time. So we should encourage responsible and accountable allies and partners to participate in maximizing their own security. This is part of that projecting deterrence, is enhancing our extended deterrence by default. And projecting deterrence is more than just sailing conventionally armed ships or flying reconnaissance aircraft near hostile, you know, AORs. It's about projecting the nuclear response capability and capacity. The adversary is not intimidated by our nuclear deterrence. They are rejecting our diplomatic influence, and they are challenging our non-nuclear power. And this is a path to conflict if we don't improve this in the way that we do power projection. Power projection needs to include nuclear deterrence projection in all the ways you can define it. So that's number two. And my third wish is a nuclear deterrence posture change. We here at NIDS last summer put out a strategy called Dynamic Parity, where we lay out how we would we lay out some plans about how we would sort of match our collective adversaries' nuclear deterrent capability. We would rise and fall as they rise and fall in a world without nuclear treaties or arms control treaties, and trying to sort of create that intolerable fear that we need to project the deterrence properly. And this means we go have to be able to be willing to do business differently. And mobile ICBMs, bombers back on alert, these sorts of things, these posture changes and maybe even more weapons, I think can help as we do the other two wish list items, which is, again, projecting deterrence and having that cultural commitment. Nations spend money on what they care about most, what is the highest priority. That's what they spend on. If you want to understand what a country believes in and values, go look at what they spend money on. And we're over here on the margins at 6% of our defense budget, discussing nuclear deterrence and modernization. Again, in a program of record that was defined 15 years ago when the world was much different. And little to show for it to date. I'm sure much is coming, and we certainly can't stop it or impede it in any way. But it may no longer be enough, and I think we have to really look at this. It starts with a cultural change, and with that change, we bring our allies along with us. So those are my three wishes, guys. I'm ready for your comments.
Once again, I would say you're probably right on track. You know, you're on target. Good wishes. I can't disagree with them. I mean,
I completely only disagree with Curtis's approach, because he always goes for more bombers, more missiles, more everything. We just need, you know, I thought he's going to, you know, rattle off an entire logistics system, you know, top to bottom, every component, you know, by nomenclature and number, because he knows them so well.
That's all inferred. That's
where I thought you were going to head there, Curtis. So I'm proud of you.
That's all inferred. I think the biggest thing here is to understand, and this may dovetail in some of where Adam's going, but I honestly believe that you know, when you look at the defense budget, you know, a third of it is people, right? 6% of it is nuclear. What's the rest of it spent on? Well, we could presume It's the war fighting capability. So that's where the money is, and that's where we're spending the most. And so my argument is that we could trade some of that off. We're almost $37 trillion in debt, and we're facing a war in the next couple of years if we don't do this right. And that's going to be much more expensive than projecting deterrence.
All right. Well, good thoughts. I don't know. I mean, there's some much needed wishes that need to be granted. And, you know, among the most important wishes that need to be granted are mine.
Of course.
So I'll offer you.
You're the host.
I'll offer you my 3 points. And now I'm going to differ, you know, dramatically from you guys and sort of what you thought. And I'm going to take, you know, Wyatt, my son, he's taking microeconomics right now at the college. And so I've really enjoyed getting to talk to him about economic concepts. So, you know, I've been on a bit of a kick, you know, with what's going on, you know, in politics and talking to Wyatt. And just I've been thinking a lot more about economics, which was always my first love. And so I want to focus on some economic issues here. So the number one thing, I want to go back to 2011 when Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that the number one threat to the United States was the national debt. Now, he said that at a time when the national debt was about $15 trillion. It was about 91% of GDP. And what's interesting about that is economists, you know, the economists have said that once your debt to GDP ratio reaches 77%, it begins to impede economic growth. It slows, it starts to reduce the average citizen, because, you know, this is true across countries. It's not just true of us. So it reduces, you know, the individual wealth of citizens, because you have to pay higher taxes, you have to so 77% is kind of the magic number you want to keep it below. So in 2011, we were at 91%. And then today we're at 123%. So even though the U.S. economy has grown tremendously, we've done well in the last decade and a half, our debt is at 123% of GDP. And we have, you know, we paid last year, first year that the national debt exceeded the amount we spend on national defense. So interest payments on the debt exceeded defense spending. That was $900 billion. And it's only set to go up. Really, if you look at what costs more than the national debt, Social Security. That's what costs more than interest payments on the debt last year. So my number one choice is we have to balance the budget, because a balanced budget is the only way that economies grow and debt does not become a hindrance to economic growth and prosperity. And so what does that mean? What that means is, so the federal government took in $4.9 trillion last year. State and local governments took in another four and a half-ish. So we spent about $10 to $11 trillion total, in paying our taxes last year. And what that means is we're already paying about 35-ish%, 40% of our income in taxes. Now, in the U.S., that's highly concentrated. So about the bottom half of all taxpayers pay nothing. So the majority of Americans don't pay income taxes. Income taxes are actually concentrated. About 3/4 are paid, of all income taxes, are paid by the top 5% of income earners. The top 1% of income earners, who they make about 40% of all dollars, they make 22% of all dollars, but they pay 43% of all taxes. So the idea, well, the rich make all the money and therefore they should pay all the taxes. Well, that's not true. They make 22% and pay 43%. So we've got to figure out a way to balance the budget. And the solution is not going to be raising taxes, because we've already, you know, I've explained that the people who pay the taxes is a relatively small slice of the American taxpayers. And so you can't just squeeze them and squeeze them, because what do people do? Well, for one, they stop working and they stop investing, and then they start hiding money, and then they start sending money overseas. That's what people do, especially high income earners, the ones who invest, they send it overseas and they hide it. And that's not what we want either. So we actually have to spend less. And so spending less means, and there's really one thing you can do. There's only one. And it's not cut the defense budget. It is cut entitlement spending. Entitlement spending was $4 trillion last year. Of the 4.9 that the federal government brought in revenue, $4 trillion was entitlements. And then add the interest on the national debt, that was $900 billion. So that's your $4.9 trillion right there. And then so defense spending, the Department of Commerce, the Department of State, all of that was paid for with the borrowed money, the $2 trillion that we borrowed last year. No normal government functions were paid for with actual tax dollars. They were all paid for with borrowed dollars. That's a problem. So what do we have to do? We have to cut entitlement spending. You have to cut Medicaid. You have to cut CHIP, and you have to cut all of these SNAP, and you have to cut all of the places where you give free money. Because we just cannot as a nation. And remember, entitlement spending, those very first entitlement programs came in with the Great Society. And so it's been subsequent to 1964 that you've really seen America without entitlements to America dependent on entitlements. And it's just not feasible. Now, if you take state and local spending, how do state and local governments spend their money? Well, they spend most of their money on entitlements. So in the end, we're spending $6 to $7 trillion a year on transfer payments from one American to another American. And it's not feasible. You cannot, and if you can't afford defense, you cannot afford to ensure that the country is safe and prosperous. So you're going to have to cut you have to cut entitlement spending. You have no choice. That's number one. It's the most important thing we could do as a country. Number two is we have to avoid fighting wars. No more silly wars. And if you think about World War II, the most expensive war we ever fought, that war in direct war cost was $5.8 trillion. $5.8 trillion was what we spent. Now, people say, well, we can't afford the cost of nuclear modernization. That's $1 to $1.5 trillion for operations and maintenance and modernization. Well, one war is four times more expensive. So we got to stop fighting wars. Or let's take a war that wasn't even a big war. Let's take Iraq and Afghanistan. That war in just direct war cost was $2 to $3 trillion. And then when you add on top of it future veterans benefits, and you add on top of replacing all of the equipment that was worn out during the fight, and when like Europe, you have to include the Marshall Program in the cost of the war. So all of these post-actual conflict costs are tremendous. What is much, 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 much cheaper is building nuclear weapons and deterring conflict. That's far cheaper. And it is not like Madeleine Albright said when she said, what's the point of having all of this fantastic equipment if you don't use it? That is not what we want to say. That fantastic equipment is to deter adversaries from attacking us. That's how you use it. You don't go wear it. You don't go fly its wings off in pointless missions that accomplish nothing, which is what we've historically done, because America has a terrible post-World War II track record of winning wars. We win battles, but we don't win wars. So let's stop fighting wars that don't fundamentally advance our interests. Let's deter our adversaries. And then finally, you touched on this, Jim. We have to rebuild the defense industrial base. And if you think about Sentinel, Sentinel is a perfect example of the fact that we bought missiles and we built silos in 1962, and we bought missiles that, you know, were largely in the ground for the last 50 years. And then the companies went out of business because we didn't modernize. So what we need is an industrial base that is efficient and cost effective. And what that means is they have to, it's like a Ford plant. If you built Ford F-150s once every 50 years, for those Fords that rolled off that assembly line once every 50 years would probably be 3 or 4 times as expensive as they are when they roll off the assembly line every day. So you create it cost effectiveness and efficiency by keeping the assembly line going, by replacing weapons as they age. That's the, and you never have these, you know, Nunn McCurdy breaches, because you know what you're doing and you know how to do it because you do it. And so you need the industrial base that allows you to do that. And that means consistent funding, regular modernization that drives prices down. It's like, you know, if you look at F-35s back in the day, they were incredibly expensive early on. And now the prices, now that they're just flowing off the line, prices are way lower. We're looking at the fact that the B-21 B-21 prices are coming in under budget, because the more they build, the cheaper they get. And this is something that works for missiles and silos and submarines. And, you know, you can't just build submarines once every 40 years. You know, it just doesn't work that way. So balance the budget, stop fighting wars, deter them with a robust nuclear enterprise and a nuclear arsenal, and then build an industrial base that modernizes regularly and is cost effective and puts the fear of God in our adversaries. Those are the three things I think are most important. And then y'alls are okay too.
Well, let me react to that, Adam. I thought those were excellent. I think the economics portion, powerful superpower, great power nations have economies that matter. And yes, the American economy matters. And I'm not trying to say that it doesn't, but our dollar is a lot less valuable. And our trade issues may not be necessarily as fair as they should be. And so these are all challenges. And more importantly, when we trade with our adversaries, we are empowering them to arm themselves against us. So I would add to that, Adam, energy. You've got to be energy independent, or you've got to have energy from reliable, trusted sources, so that you don't have to do the alternative, which is, again, trade with your adversary or do without, because then that can cause war. And the defense, the no more frivolous wars, again, that goes to this idea that if we arm for deterrence and less for defense, we inevitably avoid those sorts of frivolous wars. And then, of course, the defense industrial base, to your point, if we're going to project deterrence, you know, being able to sell B-21s to allies or submarines or whatever helps lower the costs for us, too, and creates great interoperability and enhances collective deterrence as we project that deterrence with our allies in order to maintain the status quo in the rules-based international order. So totally agree with where you're going. They fit nicely with mine. So actually, I think mine are a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, let me put my two cents in here at the very end. And first of all, I think this collective, we have 9 points for our listeners that came out here. But I will mention that they all basically support my 3. And and since we got some feedback from at least a few listeners that they were looking for more controversy, so I'll say Adam and Curtis are wrong. So there's your controversy.
That's controversy. That's just Wednesday.
but seriously, Curtis, yours is a core, your comment I was going to ask, since Adam only wanted 3, because that's what he asked for. I didn't want to put in my I was going to make it a 1B, which was one way to revitalize our nuclear enterprise is with many of the same skills that you get when you build nuclear energy. Interestingly, my wife, and for those viewers, we'll see, I'm going to put in front of my camera here, an Omni magazine. I'm not going to tell you what it says. 1988 Omni magazine. For those of you that are needleheads like me, you know that Omni was a great magazine to teach you science and everything else. Some really good stories. And I'm not selling the magazine. Actually, this is a used one from that time. But here's the main thing. Nuclear renaissance. Reactors are back and reactions are good. That was 1988. What happened? We've got to build all of these concepts into a long-term strategy. These can't be just fly by night, because as you know, what Adam's saying about, you know, you build and then you learn, you know, one thing that his concept of modernization being sort of a continuous effort, it keeps that workforce so you don't keep falling behind by your 15-year experts every 15 years. Now you're 30-year experts, you know, you're 30 years behind on your 15-year experts.
Yeah.
But anyway, the other thing that it does, though, is it develops all the skill sets that you need. And then I do want to make another comment about Adam's comment about economy. And this is the hard part. And I'm not a politician. I never claim to be one. I never want to be one. I don't care to be one. I pity those that are. But the politicians, how do you go out and you get rid of a lot of these programs that people have become dependent on? And my view is, again, starting with people have to understand, you just can't keep going in this one direction. But the other thing is there are risks in that direction we can take away by building a better deterrent and avoiding wars. Because that's the flip side. You know, you get all your entitlements and then you go to war. I don't think that's necessarily what we want to be as a country. I think what we want to be is stable and long-term stability comes from a strong economic stance and a strong deterrent stance that includes defense, isn't defense, but includes defense as part of the deterrence. But remember, everybody, as Curtis would say, defense is not deterrence. I'll turn it back to Adam. We're just about out.
All right. Well, we've used our time for the day. Hopefully it was at least a little bit informative and entertaining for the listeners. So we want to thank you for joining us on this episode of The NIDS View. And of course, we want to always remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.